Hello and welcome to Great Lives. My guest this week is a man who once made Peter Mandelson and John Prescott dance. But times and people change. Or do they? In a moment I'll ask him. Brian Cox played keyboard on the D-Ream hit Things Can Only Get Better, the soundtrack to the arrival of New Labour in 1997. Today, Brian is Professor of Physics at Manchester University, works at CERN on the Large Hadron Collider, and is a science presenter on BBC Radio and Television, most recently presenting a really notable BBC Two series, Wonders of the Solar System. Ever tempted, Brian, to give up trying to explain for the umpteenth time that, yes, you are the same Brian Cox who played keyboard in D-Ream, and simply separate the two lives and start replying, no, that was the other one?
You know, in a sense, I've forgotten what it's like to be in a band. I mean, that was 1992 when we recorded that song. And, of course, it was resurrected, dragged from the dead in 1997 for New Labour. But I've not thought about it since.
Do you ever in any sense regret not your support for Tony Blair and New Labour, but getting your artistic life roped together in the public mind with political allegiances?
I am quite political, actually, but I'm quite single issue. I mean, for me, science is the foundation of our civilization. I really genuinely believe that. So I'm political in a sense that the party that supports science the best for me is the party that I would vote for, all other things being equal, of course. And so I really feel politicised by the issue of science funding.
I'll obviously be wanting to ask you how it came about that the scientist in you jostled with the musician, but I suspect something of your answer may be found in the life you've chosen. Whom have you chosen as your great life?
Well, I've chosen Carl Sagan for many reasons. I suppose the first time I saw him was presenting Cosmos, which was the great science documentary series, I think. I don't think it's been bettered. There were 13 of them, 13 hours of science documentary. And it was on when I was, 12 years old, the perfect age
yes.
to see a series like that. And it was the thing that really convinced me that I should be a scientist. I'd been interested in astronomy for many years, but just seeing that on television with Sagan is unique. Actually, emotional and polemical approach to science just captured my imagination.
I wonder how many people he planted the same seed of fascination with science in their minds. No one can ever calculate these things.
It must have been thousands, if not tens of thousands. And I think that's one of the goals of anyone who wants to spread the word and encourage our society to be more scientific. I think Sagan is the benchmark.
Before us is the cosmos on the grandest scale we know. We are far from the shores of Earth, in the uncharted reaches of the cosmic ocean. Strewn like sea froth on the waves of space are innumerable faint tendrils of light, some of them containing hundreds of billions of suns. These are the galaxies, drifting endlessly in the great cosmic dark.
Carl Sagan on a typical flight of the imagination into the cosmos. Joining us from a studio in California to flesh out the life of Carl Sagan is his biographer, Key Davidson. Key, Sagan is known in this country for Cosmos, that's his legacy. From your knowledge of the man, is this soft-focus image of a scientist with a childlike wonder an accurate picture of who Carl Sagan really was?
Well, it's certainly an accurate picture of a major part of his life. He was also a planetary scientist. He was a complicated man who walked, you might say, a kind of tightrope between the quote-unquote rational worlds and the irrational worlds. And opinions on him were very divided, both in the public community because of his political activism, and in the scientific community, which both revered him as a popularizer of science, but also was uneasy, feeling that sometimes he was an irresponsible scientific speculator. He's a very complicated figure.
I want to come on to a lot of these themes later on, but first, his origins. He was born in Brooklyn on November the 9th, 1934. Key, what role did his parents, Rachel and Sam, have in shaping the ambitions of the boy Carl?
His mother had huge impact on him. She was like his father, somebody who was basically a refugee from pogroms in Russia and in Austria. and they were determined that their boy would make his way in the American world, which they saw as, in effect, the new Israel. And this was before the foundation of the political Israel state. And parents were basically working class. They worked in the garment industry, and it was quite a struggle. But they saw to it that their boy ultimately ended up going to the University of Chicago, where he was extraordinarily lucky to be exposed to a moment in the history of science when so many different factors were coming together: the beginning of the rocket age, the beginning of research into the origin of life, the beginning of the serious exploration of our planetary system orbiting the sun. And he leaped on that surfboard, and he surfboarded it to the end of his career. He was quite brilliant when he was young. Not a genius, not an Einstein, but quite brilliant as far as high school boys go.
His mother absolutely adored him, didn't she?
Oh, yes. For better or for worse, she adored him and undoubtedly was the decisive factor in his life. In fact, there's no question that if his mother had not made a particular suggestion to him at a certain point in time to meet a particular scientist, that Sagan's life might not have amounted to much. But she pushed him to do things that he needed to do, and she really launched him, in effect, like a rocket.
It was said of Carl Sagan that his mother worshipped the ground he floated above, which was a nice way of
I think that's a nice way to characterize it, yes.
Were your parents, Brian, in the same way important in implanting ideas or ambitions or self-confidence in you?
They weren't scientific. What I remember growing up in my house was that my dad was a fan of Apollo. I mean, I was born in 68, so I watched the moon landing in 69, apparently, but of course I don't remember it. But I do remember growing up in a house where on the wall there were pictures of Apollo, there were newspaper clippings of Apollo. So I was in that atmosphere that came just after that. We went to the moon. I think it's the most remarkable thing we've done as a civilization. I think we overstretched, absolutely overstretched. We weren't ready to go, but we did. And that seeped in, you know. So as far back as I can remember, I was interested in space travel, astronomy. Star Wars actually came along in 1977. It was no different to me. As an 8 or 9 year old, science fiction, science fact, it's all there. And then came Cosmos.
Here is Carl Sagan describing how his eyes were opened to the wonders of science by a childhood trip to the library.
The question of what the stars were, I mean, you could see them. They were different from everything else in Brooklyn. But nobody seemed to be able to tell me what they were. They said, they're lights in the sky, kid. And I could tell they were lights in the sky, but I had the sense there had to be some deeper explanation. I mean, just little lamps hanging from the sky, whatever for? How did they get there? What were they doing? One of the most ecstatic moments of my early years was when, with my first library card, I went to the library and asked for a book on stars, and after some confusion about Betty Grable and Clark Gable, I got the right sort of book, and it said this absolutely astonishing fact. It said that the sun was a star, but close up, that the stars were suns, but impossibly far away, and suddenly the universe became much larger than Brooklyn.
Brian, you had your moment on the road to Damascus watching Cosmos. What did you actually do next? Did you demand a telescope? Did you start waking up and listening in physics lessons at school?
I did. I got a small telescope, and then I remember at the age of... Well, I had just got to senior school to start doing physics, and I wanted to do that exclusively, to the point of ignoring French lessons and failing, subsequently, O-level French, because I felt it was useless. I've now ended up working in Geneva at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, so it was a mistake. But I remember being singularly focused on physics.
Yeah. The young Carl Sagan, of course, at this stage in his career, he hasn't become a media star. Was he always a good communicator, and was he immediately a good scientist?
Well, he was certainly a very energetic communicator early on. He loved giving little talks in school. He was a superb speaker. He had that wonderful, slightly strange sort of halting way of speaking that made his voice so distinctive. And he also was a huge fan of science fiction. This is something that I think he did not really begin to admit much until his later years. When he was young, he was also a huge enthusiast for flying saucers. At that time, in the late 40s, the early 50s, there were many flying saucer sightings, and some people thought that the Earth was being visited by other worlds. And he actually did his first radio broadcast when he was a young student at the University of Chicago on the student radio station. He gave this talk. I found the transcript of it, about how we might be being visited by creatures from other worlds. So I sometimes tell parents, if your child reads comics and graphic novels and watches TV, science fiction, and so forth, don't worry about it. They're stimulating their imaginations, and it'll pay off in later years.
That sense of wonder, it's a cliche in a way, but you hear it. You know, it suffuses everything Sagan did. And it's important, and I think it knows no boundaries when you're a kid. You know, I mean, I couldn't separate, I didn't care to separate science fiction from science fact. For me, it was my imagination just reaching out to other worlds. And so I understand, and I didn't know that about Carl, actually, that he was a big fan of science fiction. But it makes sense, because it's the same for me.
There is some reason to believe that many of the ways in which he speculated about extraterrestrial creatures, what their civilizations might be like, what their relationships might be like with Earth if we ever contact them, seemed to me like after effects, afterglows of a lost religious faith in youth.
I do think now that the seed of a love of science and the seed of religiosity is very similar, actually. I thought about this a lot, because I think you have to, first of all, notice that the universe, the cosmos, is beautiful and worth explaining.
I'm doubtful about this. It all sounds a little bit lush to me. I mean, you've talked about wonder, and your series is called The Wonders of the Solar System. You deliberately set out to show how wonderful it was. But wonderful is not a term known to science, and wonder, I don't see why wonder should be an important part of the scientific spirit. Isn't there a danger that in popularising, for instance, astronomy, we diminish it as science and throw into prominence aspects, displays, awesomenesses that are actually no more important scientifically than less exotic data?
No, I don't think so at all, actually, because I think if you go back in time, and we heard Carl Sagan talking lyrically about his childhood, and I was the same, there's a sense... For me, I think there was a sense of awe, and it's very difficult to describe. But if you see the stars, and as Sagan said, you understand what they are. They're these billions of suns there. That's an emotional response to the universe, and I do believe that that's the thing that triggers you, and it can send you on a path of wanting to understand it. And then I would agree with you. You've got to, as a professional scientist, the path to understanding is modest and careful, but the thing that sets you off on that road is surely the firing of your imagination about nature.
Key.
And also, I think Carl emphasized in his TV show Cosmos that in the history of science, often the great theoretical leaps, the great paradigm shifts, come from scientists who are not necessarily people that we would think of as hard-boiled rationalists. And Kepler is one of the great examples. This is one of the most fascinating figures in the history of science. There was a whole episode of Cosmos about him, a man who, on the one hand, cast astrological horoscopes, and yet, on the other hand, came up with the notion that the planets orbit the sun elliptically rather than in perfect circles, which was really the decisive breakthrough in the scientific revolution of the 17th century, paving the path to Newton and everything since. And Sagan spoke very respectfully of figures like that who were not afraid to walk that sort of twilight zone between the so-called rational and the so-called irrational. It's amazing in the history of science how often great scientists have been driven by impulses that nowadays some people might sniff at as being rather irrational. And yet they were great scientists. Einstein is another example.
Brian, Carl Sagan spent a lot of his screen time just looking a bit awestruck as he stared out of his virtual
spacecraft.
I do. That looks a bit cheesy now in retrospect. Was he parodied at the time? He would be now.
Yes, I remember him running around tearing dandelions up all over the place and blowing these dandelion seeds away. It's one of the images that sticks with me, terrorizing fields of dandelions. But I think that to make a good documentary about science, you've got to try and get across your sense of wonder, your personal sense of wonder. And I think it is the appropriate word.
I hate to say something demystifying, but Carl fought bitterly with his producer, Adrian Malone. Carl later claimed that the reason there were so many of those close-up shots of him looking silly and egotistical was because Malone put them in to deliberately make Sagan look awful. That might just be an apocryphal story.
I wanted to ask you about that, in fact, Key, because you know, although Sagan's multitude of admirers would call him driven and determined, his critics called him arrogant and self-centered. Which way does the balance tip for you?
You know, he's a marvelous biographical subject because he's one of those people about whom people have very, very split opinions. I met no one who knew him truly well who purely hated him or purely loved him. People had very complex and interesting reactions to the man. They adored him in many ways. They were inspired by him, moved by him, and they sometimes had very bitter falling outs with him that they regretted bitterly because they missed him. They really did.
The human side could be a bit egocentric.
Terribly.
And
he recorded
a tape to go on board a flight to Mars. That could be played by astronauts whenever they finally reach Mars, a tape of him speculating about why they were going to Mars. You know, I'm trying to put myself in the position of these notional pioneers at that notional juncture and thinking, probably they'll have other things on their minds than Carl Sagan.
Oh, absolutely. In some ways, he's best thought of, as far as things like that, as a performance artist with a NASA-sized budget. And some of the stunts that he engaged in, they were stunts, but they were stunts that probably will resonate through history. The Voyager plaque with the image on it showing the man and the woman. That plaque now, we can look back on it alternately laughing and also being moved by it because it is now the farthest human artifact in the galaxy. I don't know how far out in space it is, but it will cross our galaxy and perhaps ultimately leave it or orbit the galactic center long after we are gone. And Carl felt that whether it's ever found by aliens or not, which is highly unlikely, this is really, it's not a message to space. It's a message to Earth. It's a message that says this is who we were at a given point in time. This is the little plaque we sent out into space, full of all of the unconscious sexisms and even perhaps subtle racisms that plaque embodied, showing people who looked very white and very blonde. The man is in the foreground addressing whoever the alien is, while the woman is in the background leaning on one knee as if uninterested. This is a plaque that already looks dated, and yet in many ways it's timeless. And it's a great work of performance art, whether it's scientifically worthwhile or not. And Sagan was responsible for that.
And of course, the great work of performance art in a way is the Pale Blue Dot picture, where Sagan had Voyager turned around and took this picture of Earth from 4 billion miles away and wrote, I think, one of the most moving pieces of prose I've ever seen about the Earth and both our insignificance and our value.
You are so right. I saw him give that speech just before he died, and I got to tell you, I'm not ashamed to admit it, I was sobbing, and a lot of people in that audience were sobbing, and there were ex-presidents in that audience. It was very moving, and not in a cheap, sentimental way. It was one of those speeches that made you feel like you're present at a moment in history, and here's someone who has his grasp on the passage of time and the meaning of time. It was just marvelous to be there.
You mentioned, Key, that his human relationships were sometimes a bit messy. He married 3 times in all. He didn't do domesticity or general human cooperation very well, did he?
No, he was a man of his time, and I underline the word man. He was one of those careerists who came out of the Second World War. He wasn't in the war, but he came out of that period believing that it was a man's world, although he certainly had strong feminist leanings. They did not necessarily translate into his personal behavior, which was another trait of men
very
of that
common
time. You know, they were like H.G. Wells. They spoke feminist talk, but then in their private lives they were often quite sexist, and Sagan was no different. His third wife, who just adored him and who had tremendous impact on him intellectually and emotionally and in every other sense, she said he never washed a dish, he never hung up a towel. He was that kind of man. He was a man of his time. But at the same time, he made it possible for many young women to have scientific careers who would not have otherwise. Many of his greatest admirers are young women who are now prominent space scientists.
Brian, do you come home from CERN and do a bit of hoovering, for instance?
I do a bit. I try my best.
Biography about private life is valuable if it helps us understand how a great man or woman became great. He was a very enthusiastic marijuana user, not at all unusual in that generation or maybe even today. And some people ask me, why did you feel you had to write about this? And I said, the reason is very simple. Because Carl wrote very articulately that he felt that the use of marijuana revolutionized his life intellectually, aesthetically, and emotionally, that it transformed him as a person.
Let's see whether we can pick up even a whiff of weed in Carl Sagan in an extract from Cosmos, reveling in the big numbers, but also offering a word of warning.
The size and age of the cosmos are beyond ordinary human understanding, lost somewhere between immensity and eternity is our tiny planetary home, the Earth. For the first time, we have the power to decide the fate of our planet and ourselves. This is a time of great danger, but our species is young and curious and brave. It shows much promise.
What Sagan was always clear about was, given what he knew about the cosmos, about the rarity of civilizations like ours, which is still the case now, then knowing that might make us behave a little differently. And he was very much a man who had a political agenda. He was striving to make our world better by telling us what we'd discovered, by using astronomy to make a better place. And that sounds a bit hippie-ish, and it can sound a bit, you know, awestruck and wonderful, perhaps, to modern ears. That's a 1970s documentary. But I think the passion and the message is still clearly there.
We've leapt in our conversation into his fame with that series, Cosmos. But, of course, that didn't just happen automatically. He had a big television break. It was the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, wasn't it, Key?
Yes, that's right. Carl Sagan and Johnny Carson engaged in a two-man conspiracy to get Americans interested in the cosmos. Carson was a serious amateur astronomer on the side, and he and Sagan hit it off right away. Sagan went on Carson's show many times. That was a time in American culture when late-night talk shows still occasionally had sophisticated people appear on them. Nowadays, if you have a sophisticate, the host uses it as a setup for a joke or a sneer. But back then, people like Carson really did try to give a forum to sophisticated intellectuals like Sagan, who, even when they were arguing with their opponents, could engage in discourse in a very civilized, polite, well-informed way that is now almost forgotten in American life. American culture now is so dominated by screaming talking heads.
That's the way it seems to be going.
It really is.
Do you think, Brian, that television is an inherently stupid medium? Certainly the pressures seem to be always pushing that way.
I don't, actually. I think that, if anything, television executives may be generally inherently stupid, but it's not the medium. And I say that because in my programme, you mentioned Wonders of the Solar System, we were given, by some very unstupid executives, really free rein. We were told that we could make a programme that should be high quality for BBC Two, and we should not care too much about the audience figures. And we did that. Actually, many millions of people watched it, to the point where it eventually beat BBC One on a Sunday night, which is incredible for BBC Two. And I think that people do not get lost in television programmes, but if they do, I don't think they turn off. I think they sit there and quite enjoy, actually, that they get lost occasionally in a documentary. So I think it is not the medium itself. It is professionals' perception of it occasionally. And there are some professionals who don't have that perception.
Does Cosmos stand the test of time? An estimated 500 million people have now seen it. But 30 years on, could you sit down to an hour a week for 13 weeks and watch something like that? Would people?
I think it does stand the test of time, yes. It's a little slower, perhaps, than television now, but that's not a bad thing. And I think Sagan carries it because I think the passion with which he delivers the ideas allows you to sit there and watch that series.
That series had moments in it that for me were equivalent to epiphanies. For example, the moment when he talked about the evolution of the Japanese crab. That was a moment when all of a sudden I could grasp great scientific truths that had previously been opaque to me. And it's amazing that a TV show can do that.
That's genuinely beautiful. There are Japanese crabs that have the face of a samurai warrior on their shells. And that's because every time a Japanese fisherman lifted the crab out of the sea and saw something that looked like the face of a warrior, he threw it back. And so those were the patterns on the shells that evolved and became set wow. in that species because there was a selection, accelerated natural selection, essentially, by the fishermen.
John Prescott once named a crab after Peter Mandelson, didn't he?
Did he?
Same process might be starting.
That's had no contribution to the evolution of the human species at all.
And Sagan argued that religion is essentially that sort of phenomenon projected onto the universe, that when people look at our universe and believe they perceive intelligent design behind it, in effect a kind of giant samurai warrior face on the face of creation, it's really a consequence of natural forces, and there's no need for a divine explanation. And it was that particular point of view that made Sagan very controversial among religious figures in his later years, because he was so blunt in pushing it across. In that sense, of course, he was there long before Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and some of the more outspoken agnostics and atheists of our time.
Did he die young, Key?
He was 62 when he died, so I guess it depends on how one defines young.
What did he die of?
He died of complications of an illness called myelodysplasia, which is a kind of leukemia, a blood disease.
Is there anything more you think he'd have done, Brian, if he had lived for longer? Was there more that he could have achieved, other fields he could have conquered?
It's hard to see what he could have done that would have topped Cosmos. It's interesting, isn't it, that when your masterpiece is completed in your 40s and not in your 60s, where do you go? I don't know.
Where do you go? You're still not 46 or 48. What might you do?
I haven't made my Cosmos yet. No. I mean,
would you like to?
I would love to make a series with the impact of Cosmos, and I'm trying to do that.
My thanks to Brian Cox and Key Davidson, and we leave you with the words of Carl Sagan describing, and you both mentioned this earlier on in the conversation, a pale blue dot on a photograph taken from 3.7 billion miles away, an image that puts all of us in our place. Goodbye.
Consider again that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on a mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam.